tonight on Arena. James McGovern of the Murder Capital on the band's new album Blindness. And in TV, Small Town, Big Story and Toxic Town are up for review. Friday night, so it's TV review night. Small Town Big Story is a new drama from Sky. It's set in the fictional Irish town of Drumban, which is suddenly under the spotlight as a major Hollywood film production comes to town. It was created and written and stars our own Chris O'Dowd, along with Christina Hendricks and Paddy Considine. From the team that brought us The Mindy Project, Running Point is a new American sports comedy. It stars Kate Hudson as Isla Gordon, whose late father overlooked her and gave all the good jobs to her brothers. But that's all changes when the eldest son takes a trip to rehab and she is appointed president of the LA Waves basketball team. Toxic Town is a drama based on the Corby toxic waste scandal in Britain, a landmark case which saw mothers in Corby band together after discovering that several of their children were born with similar birth defects. The women fought the council for justice as they believed the defects were caused by leakages of toxic waste as it moved through their areas. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have watched all three and join me now in the studio. We'll begin close to home with Chris O'Dowd's Small Town Big Story, which he created, wrote and starred and even found time to direct a few episodes. A Hollywood production company rolls into a small Irish town to make a movie, but the producer, Wendy Patterson, played by Christina Hendricks, who used to live there and even had a fling with the local doctor, but fled after events that happened at the Millennium. Jen, can you set the scene for us here in the heart of Small Town Big Story?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe because I don't think it kind of knows what it wants to be itself. It's not a straightforward comedy. It might look like that from the outside. You have like this small, quirky, fictional village of Drumban, which has, you know, been green lit through very dodgy circumstances by the locals. They were kind of doing a bit of trickery with the closest other town, Boyle, to actually nab this Hollywood as this Hollywood, the location for this American drama that's coming over about the Celts. And it's supposed to be like this more realistic version maybe of a mythical story that's a little bit Game of Thrones. So the producer of this would-be smash hit, as you said, is Wendy Patterson. So she's returning, who's played by Mad Men's Christina Hendricks, and she is returning with slight trepidation because she thought she had left that, you know, the small town whispers behind her. And she was involved with Paddy Considine's character, who is Dr. Proctor, his Seamus, and they were old flames. So really it should be this story about maybe, you know, the old flame coming back to the small town behaviours, the eccentric kind of characters that you meet. But then it also has this totally different story tacked onto it about what exactly happened that caused Wendy to flee around the turn of the millennium. So on New Year's Eve, what happened between her and Seamus in this forest that made her abandon the town itself, and why are the people of the townspeople still talking about her to this very day? Now, with that, are you getting a lot of humour? You can see where Chris O'Dowd is kind of coming from, because this could be a story about these two people circling each other again and the colourful eccentrics. And the eccentric characters basically, I think, draw a lot of inspiration from the 90s comic drama, Northern Exposure. And Northern Exposure was kind of like the kinder flip side to David Lynch's Twin Peaks. So like, it's Twin Peaks without the murderous rage and the terrible secrets that Twin Peaks had. And I think that's the vibe that Chris O'Dowd wanted for this show, where you have birds falling from the sky that the locals don't really seem to care about. You have this guy on screen that's doing these ads, advertisements for his gym, which is kind of like a mix between Maury from Goodfellas, where you keep on seeing that ad all the time, mm-hmm. and Ben Dunn, like a kind of bro version of Ben Dunn. And all of that is enough to make you kind of interested enough and go, this is Chris O'Dowd, this is what he does.
Well, let's take a clip, which will give an idea of that kind of more eccentric style that he's trying to create for Small Town Big Story. Here, Seamus Proctor, Dunban's local GP, played by Paddy Considine, visits Betty Battles in her home, with her son Barry joining them later. Betty and Barry are played by Ruth McCann and Andrew Bennett.
Will you follow the light, please, Mrs. Battles?
Miss,
Battles, please, Doctor. Mr. Battles has been making the ground colder for 30 years now. You're married, aren't you?
Seamus. Yeah, that's my name. The wife has a name of her own, no doubt, and one of these days, by God, I swear I'll learn it.
Your blood pressure's a little high.
You promised to take it easy on the rowing machine?
Well, I've clearly been overindulging myself with excessive masturbation, Seamus. It's an issue I've struggled with my whole life.
I might head off, so.
Cool enough, Shimmy. I'll walk you out.
Mere grains of sand are we floating uselessly through space and time. Grains of sand fighting over who's the wettest.
Right, you are, Mammy. Now, thanks for making the house call. I know we're out of the way.
Did you pay the doctor, Barry?
I did, Mammy. I mean, that's not really the way it works, but don't worry, the doctor will be well taken care of.
That makes one of us so.
Ruth McCabe there, not McCann, as Betty, and Andrew Bennett as Barry, and Penny Considine, who plays the doctor. So this is the life that the doctor has in the town, meeting these eccentric people.
Yes.
So what happens then when the Wendy character comes back into the town and into his life?
Well, his life is kind of turned upside down and inside out. And as you can hear from that clip, there's a lot of talk in this series, but very few characters are actually saying anything. But Dr. Proctor, he does seem to have this happy life from the outset. You know, he's married to Catherine, who's a school teacher, played by Eileen Walsh. They have two kids together. You know, he's got his successful practice, but there are cracks and there are secrets everywhere. He's got a son who's dropped out of med school. His wife was involved in an accident, is now a wheelchair user 10 years before, and that's clearly had some sort of impact on their marriage, to the extent now where she's actually having this quite cartoonish affair with a fellow school teacher, Matt, played by Peter McGann. And he himself might be a little bit ill, you know, and every time someone mentions, you know, cancer, or he says, don't mention the C word, you can't do that in a doctor's home. So there's a little bit of ominous foreshadowing there. But when Wendy appears back in his life, it forces him to kind of think about this secret that they share, which is that they might have seen aliens at the turn of the millennium. And that's not really a spoiler. That's not a spoiler at all. I mean, it's on the side of every second bus. It's in the trailer itself, that they did have some sort of extraterrestrial, you know, close encounter in 1999.
Yes, and in the opening scene, we do see this event, but we're not quite sure as viewers what's happening.
But we learned that Wendy, wanted to talk to people about it and wanted to talk to her dad, played by Ian McElhenney, about it. But, you know, if you grow up in small town Ireland and if you tell people that, you know, you might have had an encounter with an alien, they're going to think you're mad. And so she fled back to America. He knew that he had to keep this a secret. But seeing her again, he decides, well, maybe, you know, I can make things up with her. There's a wonderful little absurd half-hour sci-fi comedy living somewhere in this, but there's just too much going on. And also, each episode kind of goes on for about an hour, which is too much. I just wanted Chris O'Dowd to pick a lane. It's like, tell a story about small town Ireland, tell a satire about, you know, this Hollywood production rolling into town, because he did actually have some real-life stories there about when he was shooting Moon Boy, he saw for himself that if you shoot a large production in a small town in Ireland, everyone's just going to lose their minds. Mm. Tell that story. You don't need the sci-fi stuff.
There is that touch of meta because, you know, that what you're talking about there, that when the Americans come in, there's also like, you know, touches on the Irish willingness to kind of play up to the Americans or, you know, at least for a price. And I think that kind of side of things is well done. We like to see, you know, the wizard behind the curtain. We like to see those shows where you can see what happens behind the scenes. And I think that's interesting. But like, I really don't know. Sometimes I feel tonally, it was just all over the place. Like you feel like Paddy Considine and Christina Hendricks are in a different show sometimes because they have to do kind of the heavy lifting. And
is that a good show? That their renewed romance.
Because what I enjoyed more, weirdly enough, is the characters around it. Because, you know, I think it's hard to... Comedy is tough and it's tough to be good on screen at comedy. I think you have to play it straight in a way. And I think if you're an actor like Eileen Walsh, which she is so versatile, she gets it, she can get that tone. I think someone like Peter McGann is great as an actor. Like, I think he's really good and one to watch. And I think they're a good double act, but they're in a different show. They're in a kind of... I don't know, sex comedy. Like,
it's
very hard to keep all these strands together. But I just don't know if there is interesting as they should be or could be. No. I think it's very messy and it's hard to keep your head in the game and know which one you're supposed to be following and which one is the most interesting. Because to be honest, I don't know how much chemistry Paddy Considine and Christina Hendricks have. And I think obviously we know how great an actor Paddy Considine is and can be hilarious if you've seen, you know, any of the Cornetto trilogy. Like he's great in those, like something yes. like Hot Fuzz. But Christina Hendricks, I don't know if she has comedy bones. And that's kind of a problem because I think you need to be adaptable. When you see someone like Deirdre O'Kane coming on the screen, you kind of relax a bit because you understand that she understands what is necessary for this role. And I think, it, like Chris says, there's something in it that it should have just been snappier, 30 minutes long episodes in and out rather than overdoing it. And yeah. I think it overstays its welcome.
There's a sense too that like everyone that's in it should be doing better because they have done better because Constantine and Hendricks are terrific. Mm. But I just think that casting Paddy Considine, great actor, but he spends most of his time trying to find an accent that fits, and that's very distracting because you know he's not Irish. And then also with Christina Hendricks, wonderful performer, great with drama, but doesn't have that comedic presence. You know, she's required to do an awful lot of goofy stuff here, and it just doesn't really work with her. So, and they're surrounded by talent. I should say Deirdre O'Kane is probably the standout performer, and she's only in it for 2 minutes.
So. And I also think Patrick Martins, who plays like a location scout Jules, he's brilliant great. Comic timing, and I loved watching him. And I think more of that, more him, more Peter yes. McGann, more of Aileen Walsh, all good. But I think the central story lacks something.
Stars out of five from you, Chris.
I just wanted Chris Adair to pick a lane. It's too broad, it's too contrived, and it's far too long. And also too amateur, given the professionals, the extraordinary professionals that are involved. 2 stars.
And from you, Jen.
2 stars. And I think just dial in that ambition a bit and give it more structure and you would have been onto a winner.
Okay, Small Town, Big Story is on Sky TV and Now TV. Born into a basketball dynasty, Isla Gordon, played by Kate Hudson, has a keen knowledge and passion for the game, but is overlooked by her sexist father, who owns the LA Waves. After his death, her brother Cam inherits the role, but when he has a very public fall from grace and has to resign, Cam appoints Isla as his new president of the club over her brothers. Chris, tell us about Running Point. What do we have here? Do you have to love basketball?
It might help, but that's not going to make the jokes any funnier, I don't think. But it's loosely, very loosely inspired by the story of Jeannie Buss, who is the controlling owner and current president of the Los Angeles Lakers, and also an executive producer here. And Mindy Kaling, Elaine Coe, Ike Barinholtz, an awful lot of talented people have come together to tell this story that does play things largely fictional. And you do have Kate Hudson playing this Isla Gordon character, as I said, inspired by Jeannie Buss, who is the most knowledgeable in her family when it comes to basketball, but unfortunately her late father, who ran the Los Angeles Waves, was a bit of a sexist jerk in an industry overflowing with sexist jerks, and he was never going to give his beloved basketball team over, you know, the ownership over to a woman. So instead he has 3 sons to pick from, and he gives it to Cam, who seems like an obvious choice. He's the cool hot one, as Isla says. He's played very well by Justin Theroux, and there's another 2 brothers there that will do some of the important work. Isla is left in charge of the charity divisions, but as you mentioned at the top there, when it transpires that Cam is actually a drug addict and, you know, is in no fit state to run a basketball team and has this PR disaster hanging over his head, he decides that Isla might be the most responsible one to give the team over to, and, you know, she's gonna run the show. Unfortunately, that does not go down well with the brothers.
Okay, we'll play that clip, which just is part of what the narrative you're telling us there. Following a traffic accident caused while he was high on drugs, Cam Gordon, played by Justin Theroux, summons his family around his hospital bed to tell them he is stepping down as president of the LA Waves.
We have a problem. I am an alcoholic and I am addicted to cocaine and crack.
Crack?
Yes, crack. I love it, okay? Now, I know this looks bad, but I'm telling all you guys, we're gonna be fine. The team is gonna be fine.
Right, I'm just, you know, trying to figure out how we're gonna phrase the press release that our team president hit a family of Dutch tourists with this car while high on crack.
Allie, relax. I didn't kill anybody.
Plus, they're gonna go back to the Netherlands $1 million richer with an NDA. You're welcome, by the way.
He has an addiction, Sandy, okay? It's a disease.
That's right.
It's like AIDS.
No, it's not like AIDS, Ness. It's like cancer.
It's like neither of those.
Yeah.
All right, listen, here's what's gonna happen. And I've already spoken to the board about it. I'm done. I am no longer the president of the team. I'm going to issue a statement saying that I'm taking a medical leave and I am stepping down. I need to fix this. I at least need to learn how to hide it better. It's a joke.
Ow!
Sorry. Now, there's still a lot to figure out, but your job is to do your jobs, okay? You still have a team to run. Any questions?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, who do we think is going to be there?
All right, take it back. No questions, all right? Just everybody just get the fuck out of here.
Even Cam's character has to prompt them that something's a joke. You're a fan of Kate Hudson, and Kate Hudson is a well-known movie star, mm-hmm. So this is a move for her to the sitcom.
Yeah, and I want her to be great. I do, because sometimes I feel with Kate Hudson, like it can feel a bit like that iconic tweet that Cher had, what's going on with my career? Because this woman was like Oscar nominated for Best Supporting Actress, you know, in Almost Famous. And then she's this rom-com queen. She's a superior Nepo baby. And then it just...
That's in Goldie Hawn.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then it felt like, you know, her career dropped off after Michael Winterbottom's disastrous The Killer Inside Me, which is just ultra violent. And then she came back in Rian Johnson's Glass Onion. But that didn't feel like it matched her talents even. You wanted something more for her because she's so charismatic, a great presence on screen. And she's a great presence on screen here. But what the problem is, with this show, it feels like when you're even listening to that clip, you're kind of thinking, oh, I've heard this a little bit before. This is kind of like Arrested Development. And, you know, Arrested Development leaned on the madness of the Bleeth family in this very specific satirical way, and it mercilessly lampooned the whims of the wealthy in this in an exaggerated way, but very funny way. But I think Running Point wants to be Arrested Development, but it wants to also share its DNA with something like Ted Lasso, which is more gentle and more kind and has, like, you know, her being this fish out of water sports sitcom where she's, you know, learning the ropes. And that's fine. But like her character is kind of like, she can't be everything and she is everything. She's a ditz. She's fallen into things. She's fallen over things. She, you know, is rallying against sexism, but also she is the savant when it comes to basketball. She knows everything about it. And it is very much, you don't really know what you're getting. It's a very confused character in that way. And I wish they'd had picked a lane in another way for her and progressed the character in that way. It's almost too much.
But there is an episodic nature about it, isn't there, Chris, with an event or an issue at each episode?
Yeah.
And is there character development and development of the bigger story of the family?
A little bit. There's a huge story in there about how the siblings discovering that they have another sibling that they didn't know about because their father had an affair some 20 years ago with the housemaid, and so they have to kind of get used to having another brother. There's also another story in there about Shade Hanks playing this toxic troublemaker on the team called Travis Bug, which would be easier to stomach, I think, if we didn't know that in real life Shade Hanks is a bit of a head of all himself. But you just know that that's going to follow the formulaic, oh, he's awful now, but he's going to learn a lesson about himself and the world later on.
This is the son of Tom Hanks.
That's the son of Tom Hanks, who, yeah, he is. He's been known to cause trouble in real life. But it's just not good enough for the talents that are involved. And it sometimes feels, you mentioned Ted Lasso, it sometimes feels as though Mindy Kaling, Elaine Coe, Ike Barinholtz, they all went away and said, you know what would be great if we did a cross between Succession and Ted Lasso? That wouldn't be great. And then this show is proof of that. And I think it's trying to, as well, kickstart some interesting conversations about sexism in the US sports industry. That's good. Have those conversations, but don't just have the characters say over and over that there is sexism.
Is the sibling rivalry good?
I found the siblings, I mean, apart from Cam, because I think Justin Theroux is actually so good.
And he is good.
You just heard him in that clip and you're like, okay, this sounds much better than it actually is. And he's not in it a lot.
No.
And you're wondering, will they develop? Because I think him and Kate Hudson play off each other the best. Whereas I think the other characters, like, I can't believe Drew Tarver is in this. And Drew Tarver is, as anyone know, like the other two, is one of the best comedies of the past decade. And he plays the youngest half-brother, Sandy. And he's just this all-business, like, CFO. But he has no personality and it's very hard for him to be funny. And I think he genuinely is a funny actor, but they don't give him the lines. And the other thing that kind of annoyed me about it was it's a very down-the-line sitcom, as in every episode has this standard pattern. Like Isla is, you know, she has a problem. She's lost a sponsor. She's lost like the trade rumors. There's something, you know, disrupting the play. And then she solves it. And then she's confronted by this new problem all before the credits roll and you're on to the next episode. Like there's nothing wrong with that structure, but I think we want more from Mindy Kaling at this stage of her career. And I think we want more with that cast. You have a brilliant cast. You've also got Max Greenfield from New Girl, who I love. He plays, you know, her fiance, Isla's fiance, who's this lovely, ordinary, nice guy. But then you also have someone like Jay Ellis, who is absolutely brilliant in Issa Rae's Insecure. And there's real chemistry between her character and his character, who is the recently divorced, he's the coach of the Waves basketball team. They're very sparky together, but there's not enough to keep you interested.
Four stars out of five from you, Chris.
I think among its biggest crimes, it also overestimates our interest in watching these people talk about behind the scenes basketball deals. That's not very interesting at all, unfortunately, not very funny. Love Hudson, but it's two stars.
Two stars from you,
yeah,
Jen.
Two stars. That ball rolled away from, got away from me, and got away from her.
We're
as
not
well.
Doing too good tonight. Now, Toxic Town is based on a regeneration project in Corby, in which an old steelworks plant was designated for a new housing development and theme park. But corrupt councillors and construction companies failed to meet health and safety standards, and the toxic waste that was released into the community caused birth defects. Jodie Whittaker and Amy Lou Wood star as two of the mothers affected. Jen, yes, from the opening credits, you can see these trucks rolling through these housing estates with this toxic sludge just spilling over.
Yeah, and it, I mean, like, look, we're in the world of, like, Jack Thorne. I mean, know that Jack Thorne, he's a great chronicler of social justice stories. So, you know, he was responsible for, like, searing drama Help, which was about the horror that was, like, the nursing home or care home neglect during COVID, and then Best Interest that focused on a family who have to decide whether or not to, you know, extend their daughter's medical treatment. And this is, could be the close sister of another one of his dramas, The Accident, which was a fictional story about a Welsh town that, you know, suffered from, there was an explosion and, you know, it was the reverberations of that accident on the town. So, yes, it's a landmark case which saw these women grouped together when they start to realise that a lot of their children have similar birth defects. And it's about, it's three central characters. So there's three different mothers. And it's this, you know, David and Goliath story of the ordinary families that are coming up against the corruption of the council, because it is, you know, Corby Council that you have what it is. Is different from what you would normally expect from Jack Thorne, because it's not about the Tory government, you know, really dismissing the working classes. It's about what happens when, say, a Labour government, or this is, you know, just at the time of New Labour with Tony Blair, this optimism where you're thinking working class, you know, regeneration is happening, and what the town want is from these quote unquote brown areas where the sludge would be, or where, you know, these industrial waste was, to turn them into green areas for the families. So the ambition of Corby Council is good, but the way that they get there is wrong. It's about cutting corners and, you know, turning a blind eye.
Chris, as Jen says, it is a David versus Goliath story, and the David is very much the women who, when they realise that they had blamed themselves for the problems that they had with their children, and then suddenly their eyes are open to what has happened to them.
That's it, especially Susan, played brilliantly by Jodie Whittaker, when she gives birth to her son Connor and realises that he might have a defect with his right hand. She doesn't know that across the ward another woman, Amy Lou Woods, Tracy, has given birth to a little girl who won't survive, and that, you know, there was a problem with their ear that wasn't taken seriously. But they're not alone. There are dozens of other families like them, and it takes them an awful long time to realise this. It's actually a journey then from the Sunday Times, who gets in touch and says, do you know that there were, you know, X amount of women also born with kids who had these disabilities, and that there might be some link to the toxic waste from the steelworks site? So they...
We're waiting for that, we get to like them and bond with them.
We do. We check in on them in the mid-90s, then 1999, 2000. It kind of tells the story from 95 up until 2007. I think artistic liberties have been taken, and Jack Thorne tells you that from the outset. But I think what I didn't like about it was the fact that Jack is taking something that's quite complicated and simplifying it a little bit too much. It's like, here's the bad guy played by Brendan Coyle, here's the kind counsellor who will give up everything, you know, he earned in his career played by Robert Carlyle to do the right thing. Here is the bit where the mothers realise that they're not alone. It's a bit too simplified at times.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Chris.
Great performances, and I do like Jack Thorne's work, but yeah, it's just it doesn't need to be so heavy handed, and I do wonder if viewers will stay with it, because the first episode in particular is quite harrowing, but we'll go with 3.5 out of 5.
3.5. And from you, Jen?
I just think, you know, working class stories are as valuable if they're about everyday things. And I think Jack Thorne has succeeded in doing that as well with something like The Virtues or, you know, This Is England with Shane Meadows. And I think this is too issues based, as Chris said, and I wonder will people stick with it. But I think sensational acting from Jodie Whittaker. You remember how good she was as like Bette Latimer in Broadchurch. You remember the fury of her. So I think, you know, a solid 3.
A solid 3. That's Toxic Town, and that is on Netflix along with Running Point. And Small Town, Big Story can be streamed on Sky or Now TV. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Gerard Byrne is an Irish artist with an international reputation for his lens-based work. In his art practice, Gerard has explored and reconstructed both highbrow and popular media, from the arts press to men's magazines to museum displays and commercial radio stations. He has taken part in Documenta 13 and Biennales in Venice, Sydney and Istanbul. In a new exhibition at the Curlin Gallery called The Struggle with the Angel, he presents an exhibition of photographs taken by a used camera bought from a friend. The exhibition is not only a set of images taken all over the world, but an exploration of photography itself. I met Gerard in the Curlin, and he began with the story of the camera.
Yeah, it's a kind of a classic side project in a way. In the autumn of 2008, I bought a camera off a friend of mine for cash in Copenhagen. It was a camera that he had made a lot of. He's an artist, Joachim Kuster, a Danish artist, and he had made a lot of amazing projects with this camera. And I had had a lot of. It shoots photographs, right? It's not a moving image camera; it's a still camera, and it's film. And it's a particular kind of camera. It's a medium format camera, which is a camera that was sort of semi-professional kind of camera. The film, it uses like bigger type of film and less images per roll. And so you had to be a bit more precise, and it's more expensive to shoot on this camera because you're using more material, basically film material. But this camera was a particular, even within that genre, this camera was a kind of an odd camera. It's a bit of a misfit camera. It's made in Japan by a company called Mamiya. It's a Mamiya 7 camera. They made them from the mid-90s until the early 2010s, I would say. They were always very expensive, very kind of coveted camera, a sort of a flaneur camera, a camera that you kind of could walk around with and took very, very good pictures. I bought the camera with a whole load of ambition and a whole load of expectation, and then I never did anything with it. That's the point, actually. I did nothing with the camera for years. I took a lot of pictures with it, but it never amounted or never appeared to amount to anything. And it was only a few years ago that I did a little open studio presentation in Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, where I've had a studio, luckily, for the last number of years. And I was kind of scrambling, thinking about what to do for this open studio. And then I realized I had accumulated all these negatives with this camera. They were all extremely eclectic, extremely sort of non-consecutive, just extremely dispersed as a kind of set of ideas. And that was the germination, in a way, of this exhibition.
So where will we start?
So what we have is, I think, 23 images. Everything's the same size, framed the same way, printed the same way. They're all black and white photographs. As I say, darkroom printed analog photographs. These photographs have never seen the inside of a computer, and that's somehow important, I think, actually, because I think over the time that I've been working with these tools, the whole idea of photography has changed radically in that time, and so I've had to rethink my understanding of what it is I'm doing or what it is I'm committed to. I realized that there's many ways in which an exhibition like this would have appeared completely self-evident in terms of how it was made 20 or 30 years ago. And now I have to explain it somehow. And that's different. And it is also about distinguishing the idea of artistic practice from all these other sort of social media, digital media realms, which have a place and have a cultural value undoubtedly, but I think it's also important to that not everything is kind of succumbs to those avaricious tendencies. So this work is very distinct in terms of how it's produced, has a singularity to it, I would say. So the first image we have here is, funnily enough, it's a photograph that's sort of damaged. It's not damaged, but the film frame, the frame of the image is fogged, as a photographer would say, which means that light has come in through the back of the camera. This camera that I use, this Mamiya 7 camera, it's now about it's probably the best part of 30 years old. This camera has seen plenty of use and it's traveled the world. So it's been beaten around and it's seen a lot of action, as they say.
Sometimes it misbehaves.
Yeah, sometimes the back door popped open, you know, and the film was fogged and I'd lose half a roll of film and I held the thing together often with rubber bands. So this is a fogged image, a partially fogged frame of an image of a graveyard. This one happens to be in Deer Isle in Maine in the US, a very old graveyard.
So are we to read something into the fogginess?
I would say it's ploy of some sort. It's pulling you in somehow. Yes, maybe it speaks to something about how the image is actually made. Yeah, the images. I mean, all the images are somehow, you know, they're made. They need light. You know, they're not made autonomously. They're made in the world. The next image is just a scene from New York, Washington Square Park. In the summer, there's lots of people hanging out, people walking through the park. It's kind of a crossroads in the middle of the park. And it's two or three people that are just kind of, yeah, interesting figures wandering through the park, very much kind of urban. I'm very interested in how the appearance of things changes over time or stays the same over time. That sounds like the most flat-footed comment, but actually it's very, very central to the way that I'm working with a camera. And that's why I'm interested in time, I'm interested in appearances, I'm interested, to say, in this kind of, the kind of subtle cultural shifts of how it's people dress differently, slightly differently 10 years apart. Sometimes it's detectable, sometimes it's not detectable. I think it's also interesting, the coincidence, I mean that in the sense of bringing things together, the idea that, I think one of the things that's interesting about the collection of images in the show is that they bring together a lot of very disparate things. And they put them side by side, and I think that's interesting, pleasurable. So, it's an image of people on a highway in the U.S. And they are actually watching an air show, and so they have a sheet laid out on the grass verge on the side of the highway, and they have like a thermos flask, and they have it's summertime, so they're kind of stripped down. And but what's interesting to me about the image is that there's a sort of ambiguity about the way in which they're looking at these planes flying overhead, because you see the figures from behind, and there's a certain tension in their bodies, which I find interesting. I shot a whole bunch of shots of these people. They didn't seem to mind.
Where were you? Were you watching
I was looking at the air show. The air show was spectacular, but then I realized that the people in some ways were more interesting than the planes. And so I kind of switched from maybe like a kind of longer lens that's more towards capturing the planes to a wider lens that captures more of the whole situation with the people in the foreground and the planes in the air in the background. And I just made a whole sequence of images of them. And it's interesting because of the light as well. It's kind of raking sunlight, evening, kind of late afternoon light. And the image just has a kind of weird, as I said, it's kind of retro character.
Is it kind of nods to American painting, maybe?
Yeah, and also to a history of American photography as well, of a certain mid-century period. And I've made other work that has engaged with that history. I'm interested in the way, and as I said earlier, we talked about appearances, and I'm interested in the idea of of how appearances might persist across time. Things might look like old things, or old things might look, you know, this is kind of weird shifts and displacements that seems to be possible in some ways with analog film, analog photography, that seems less possible with digital somehow. And that's not to be kind of judgy or puritanical. That's not my point at all. But at the same time, I want to point to the differences between things. This is an image of my deceased mother from a few years ago, Margaret, Margie, as she was known. Obviously, this was her in her later years when she was undergoing chemotherapy, and it's her with my son Hugo when he was probably about 12 or 13 years old. And it's a difficult image. It's an awkward image. My mom's not looking at me as I take her picture, but my son, who's sort of behind her a little bit and to the left and is a bit out of focus, is looking at me. And there's a sort of a weird triangular complexity to the relationships between the three of us. Again, it speaks to a certain history within photography, family photographs of the relationship between photography and mortality, which is a very, very deep rooted history, the relationship between photography and death.
Yeah. What's that relationship between photography?
Well, there's a long standing, you know, kind of, I mean, if you think before people had kind of assimilated photography into their kind of cultures, there was this idea that this was a kind of, a likeness that persisted after death, and that was uncanny, and that was difficult to understand, and difficult to place culturally. And so there's all sorts of kind of histories around that.
Have potency, though, don't they?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, we've all suffered losses in our lives and bereavements. I think that most people, part of the grieving process is a certain kind of process of maybe inventorying imagery, you know, and certainly I, like everybody, you know, I went through that process with my mother's passing, and I have the same relationship with that sentimental relationship with images as everybody does in that regard. But in this context, I also felt that there was a place for this image within the project, and I felt that it added something to the, it added a certain import maybe, or a certain commitment to the body of work overall, I think.
Was your mom a big supporter of your work?
Oh yeah, of course. She's a great mom. So she was fantastic, so.
Gerard Byrne, The Struggle with the Angel, opens in the Curlin Gallery in Dublin on Saturday, March the 1st, and runs until April the 5th. More information from curlingallery.com. Since emerging from Dublin's music scene in 2018, the Murder Capital have carved out a distinctive space with their raw, emotionally charged soundscapes. Their debut album, When I Have Fears, tackled grief and loss, while their follow-up album, Gigi's Recovery, expanded their sound with synth and keys. Now their third album, Blindness, was recorded in Los Angeles, and it's shaped by the city's energy. Frontman James McGovern delves into complex themes of identity, patriotism, faith and love, reflecting on life abroad and cultural shifts back home. I'm delighted to be joined by James McGovern in studio, and this is from the album This Is Love of Country. That's Love of Country from the Murder Capital's new album, Blindness. And I'm delighted to be joined by band member and lead singer James McGovern. James, Blindness is your third album and does mark an evolution in your sound. But the title, Blindness, what does it signify for you?
Yeah, nice to be here, Kay, by the way. It's I think this was the first record we didn't have a title for when we recorded it. So when we'd finished and we were mixing and mastering, I was kind of combing through the lyrics and trying to find the binding agent, I think, between the themes that you so eloquently mentioned at the top of the show there. It was kind of all of these things, this love, distorted patriotism, obsession, faith, and sort of, you know, Irishness as well, were all in there. And I think that binding agent was that I saw was the kind of limited field of perspective that we all have in the human experience in some ways, and blindness kind of stuck.
Yes, because that track there, A Love of Country, that is about our notions of patriotism and maybe how that can go a bit off at times.
Yeah, and I think maybe more so kind of the conflation of patriotism and nationalist ideologies, you know. Asking the question as to why does that sort of sense of loving Ireland and protecting its culture seem to come with the hatred of other people?
Yes, so, and it's, was it inspired by the riots in Dublin, or it was one of many inspirations for the song?
Yeah, there are a few things in there. I think there's some imagery in there from the times of the pandemic. As far as I think one of the lads reminded me the other day that actually when I wrote those lyrics kind of as a poem first, that was about a week after the riots, you know, so it was certainly floating around the conscious.
And now the band are living in different places internationally, a lot of you at the moment. So does that give you a different perspective to looking back on Ireland?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the rose tint grows ever more contrasted every day. You know, you just sort of miss home more and more. And so it's not a, none of these questions are made with a judgmental eye. You know, it's, I think, you know, sometimes you have to, it's harder to look at the things you love, you know, for what's wrong with them, you know.
So you recorded the album in Los Angeles, and that obviously did that, the energy of that city, did that kind of infuse the energy that's very evidently in this album?
Yeah, in many ways it did, you know. It was a very sort of disjointed kind of feeling over there. This is obviously, you know, the beginning of 2024, I guess. We were somewhere in maybe March in 2024, I think. So long before they had these terrible fires of late, you know, but it was still, for lack of better imagery, I would say that it's like an experience of heaven and hell, you know, of the people who have the most in the world and these kind of incredible homes, and you'd be at mad parties and up in the hills and stuff like that, and at the same time you'd come across depravity of its, you know, most tragic.
And how then did you try and funnel that into an energy that got into the studio and into the recordings?
I think when you're making an album, kind of when you're making anything, you know, you're really infused with your environment. So we didn't have to do much other than pick up the instruments. We just tried to... We did it in 3 weeks, you know, so there's really... there's a little bit of room there, but not really. You know, we worked up until the very last second of those 3 weeks. It was, you know, the energy was always there.
Right. And your producer had the idea of that you wouldn't demo tracks, but that you'd do some phone recordings and then kind of try and be organic in what was happening in the studio.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We spent a long time down in Wexford working on Gigi's Recovery, our second album. Demoing the songs to bits, and this one we just threw a phone down in the middle of the floor and played our instruments together, you know what I mean, and sang together, and that way by the time we got to LA it was like the music could kind of just be anything, you know. We had these songs that we loved, these frazzled phone recordings that we loved, which kind of meant even more, you know, they were sort of untethered.
James, the imagery in your songwriting is always distinctive, but in this album there is some fantastic imagery, a lot about death and funerals, and in particular in Death of a Giant. Let's take a listen.
It was the death of a giant, the
That's Death of a Giant from the Murder Capital's latest album, Blindness. I'm talking to James McGovern, the lead singer with the band. James, you said that track was inspired by Shane McGowan's funeral.
Yeah. We were in that same writing trip in Dublin. We were in Temple Lane Studios where we got like Words Lost Meaning. We worked on, I think, A Distant Life. And one of the mornings just so happened to be Shane's procession. Moving through the city, and we went down to Pier Street and we watched it, you know, and it was just one of those scenes, you know, like I think actually if there's one thing that really resonates with me about living abroad is just how incredible and healthy our relationship is with death in Ireland, you know, and how our closeness with death and the way that we celebrate life is just so potent in comparison to other cultures. Especially over in England, I find, you know, they have such a sort of a strange relationship with funerals. So Shane's was, of course, a great celebration, you know, and just to see those black horses with the feathers in their hair pulling the carriage, you know, with Shane's casket and the marching band and, you know, that beautiful chemist at the top of Pier Street as well where people were singing songs. A really beautiful moment, I think, and we weren't there, you know, in any way to think about writing a song about it or anything like that, but kind of a first in a way to have such a documentary kind of style tune. Yeah,
and another great
for us, a first for us, Kate.
And another great who is not afraid of the dark is Nick Cave, and you were playing support to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and he listened to Blindness.
That's right. Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so
he told us over his sandwich that he was into it. Yeah, so
you must be pretty connected with Nick Cave, given your, you know, darkish vision at times and your imagery.
Yeah,
you must have a lot to talk about late at night after the gigs.
I'd be remiss if I didn't say I do try to find the light as well, Kay. You know, it's not all dark, but yeah, I think Nick and us have some sort of a symbiotic, or we're in simpatico in some ways together in the things we explore. And you know, he's a person who he's done a lot of thinking for all of us, I think, in many ways. And it was just kind of unreal to be on tour and be able to watch him, watch Warren, the whole band. Colin Greenwood was playing with them at the time as well, and just surreal experience.
Thanks so much, James, for coming in and talking to us about the Murder Capital's new album, Blindness. It was released last Friday, and the Murder Capital play Dublin's Ivy Gardens on July the 19th. More details on themurdercapital.com. We'll leave you with another track from Blindness. This is The Fall.
Without an escape, I'll send myself spare.